Hello, hello everyone. Alex here. Just wanted to say thank you for your patience regarding the release date of this episode. It should be going out Friday evening. The reason for the delay is Bruno was supposed to be editing, but unfortunately he's come down very, very ill. Nonetheless, really, really good episode. Plenty of chat. Really, really hope you enjoy it. I will actually be at United away as well, so if you do recognise me or Bobby, we'll definitely be there. So feel free to come over and say hello. But other than that, just a quick note to say again, thank you for your support. Up the Palace and enjoy the episode.
Hey, hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way Podcast. I am Pat. Happy to bring back Pod Max. Max, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Pat. Happy to be back again. Big conversations to be had today, though.
Yeah, a lot of interesting topics from the weekend and from today, this Monday, right after the weekend. A lot of big news. All right, so here to talk with us is Bobby Manzi, sports journalist. How are you, Bobby?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Busy, but wouldn't have it any other way.
Very busy indeed. And before we get into the match and the results on the weekend, I'd like to jump right into the injury reports that we have heard. Bob's announced that Shadi Riad is out for the season with an ACL tear. At best, probably looking at October of the beginning of next season for him. And Cheick Doucouré, I believe it was a meniscus injury. Bobby, I'll let you get into the details of that. But out for the season, expected to possibly be back for the preseason. But both of those players now out for the season. With Chalobah being gone already, the cupboard was a little bare to begin with. Now these two injuries just seem a little more threadbare than we started off today. So, Bobby, what are you feeling about these injuries? How does it leave the club? And do you have any details of exactly what happened and how long they're supposed to be out for?
I concur with everything you said, really. I expect both players to be out for the entire season. I mean, it's a massive blow, not both for Palace's squad depth, but to the two players. I mean, I have to feel sorry for Cheick Doucouré. Two season-ending injuries in consecutive campaigns. It's really disappointing. He's probably one of the best talents the club have ever signed in midfield. Was going to be sold for a huge transfer fee. You know, there was talks of around the £60-70 million mark, which would have just been massive for Crystal Palace Football Club. And unfortunately, as I say, he's been hindered by two real injuries, and it's a massive blow. It's very disappointing. He's a player I think would have had a big impact in the back end of the season. In the last few games, you know, starting to get back to his former self, not perfect by any means, but he was certainly improving. And it's really, really disappointing. And as for Chadi Riad, you know, he joined the club with expectation. Not often Crystal Palace sign a defender from Barcelona, so there was certainly expectation around him. An MCL injury that's now turned into an ACL injury or a re-injury, if you like, with now an ACL, which is obviously much more severe. And it's going to be it's disappointing to miss him out. You've lost Trevor Chalobah already, so that's another two centre backs gone. And you would expect Palace to head into the transfer market with a week remaining in the window to try and repair that void in defence.
And you know, unfortunate, I think is a great term to use here, and to kind of get people off the ledge about the always these injuries, what's going on at Crystal Palace, there must be something going on. I would like to take a second and kind of elaborate on that. You know, in a previous life, so as you will, this was my expertise. Returning listeners may know that I'm referring to working as a strength and conditioning coach and rehab specialist in professional sports and professional baseball here in the States. So I have rehabbed both of these injuries. And one thing about the way these injuries happen, 95% of the time, 99% of the time, a high percent of the time, these are what we would call mechanical injuries. They happen just from the way the limb is placed, the stress you're putting on the joint. There might be impact. It might just be the angle that you're taking. Usually kind of one step non-contact injuries, or they can happen with blunt contact on trauma. What these are normally not are muscle injuries that are from overuse, right? We looked at back, you know, a few years ago at Palace, and we were having all these hamstring injuries, hamstring strains. That's from overuse injuries. That's from not being able to mitigate the volume in the training, the intensity in the training to enable you to stay durable during the season in matches. These are different types of injuries. So I would classify an ACL injury and a meniscus injury as unfortunate, unlucky, just bad situations. With Riad, is there a chance that maybe he came back too soon from that injury he suffered in the beginning of the season? We could argue that, sure. but I want to back away everybody that's
on
the
board. Just to come in, I think it's really difficult to make that point, actually, that he made a comeback too early. Because, yes, he had one
100%.
Yes, he had one setback, which kept him out of training for a week. But then in the next under-23s game, he looked fine. When he played, as in injury-wise, he wasn't like the most magnificent performance, but he looked all right. He came through the cup game, was it, unscathed? So, yeah, I think it's difficult that. But I do think once you've done your MCL, there's clearly a weakness in that knee area, and the risk is that high that you're going to do an ACL or redo an MCL. So I think you used the right word in unfortunate, and just very, very disappointing.
Yeah, it is. And either, again, I'm in the same boat as you. I don't think that he came back too early. One thing that Oliver Glasner has done very well since he's arrived at this club is he seems to have a very good grip on the training room with the sports science, with making sure that these players are not getting too much volume, too much intensity. We haven't really seen a lot of those overuse injuries that we saw with previous managers at the club. So I would say that they're erring on the side of caution there as well. But it definitely does, whether it was whose fault it was or whether it's just a fluke or just misfortune, we stand where we stand, where we're a lot shorter in both the midfield room and in where we're having in the central defense. So, Max, I'll bring you in. Where does the outlook look for those positions? Is this something where you could see having to shift a player out of position to cover? Is this something where you could see changing the formation, maybe going four at the back to try and mitigate some of these weaknesses and losses? Or are you just trying to kind of play it out and trust Glasner and see what happens here?
Well, I think ultimately, I do trust Glasner. I think he does have... I trust him to make these right decisions. But in terms of like looking forward, in terms of what like the options are, I think with the Decore injury, we need Wharton back ASAP. I don't think that's really negotiable in terms of how we're going to line up and really try and push on for the rest of the season. But like we just said, he's not going to be rushed back, which is obviously the right thing to do. But last time I was on with you, Pat, and we were talking about the Richards and Riyad argument, the fact that now we are kind of pushed into this Richards option, which kind of seems to be the only viable option, really, unless we make the argument of we bring Mitchell into that left centre-back role, let Gay go over to the right, and then mystery man at left-back, left wing-back, whoever that's going to be, comes in. I don't know if that's the right move to bring Mitchell in there, but we really need this attacking outlet further up that I don't personally think that Mitchell brings. This is exactly why we need this other option, because if Mitchell does, on this occasion, if he does happen to drop into that left centre-back role, well, what do we do? I don't understand where the room is there. But also, I wanted to highlight, if Glasner has made many comments before about how he wants to go all out for the FA Cup, obviously he went out for Carabao Cup as well, but he's really made a point that he's taken this tournament seriously, especially now we're in this typical Palace part of the season where we're probably not going to go down. We're not really looking to push into that top half European fighting spots we spoke about before the season started. So there isn't any room in these FA Cup games, providing we do get through after Doncaster. So there's no room for any rotation there, but without bringing in maybe unproven players. I just think it's a bit... It just emphasises the point that we need to act urgently now.
It does, and that is a great point you bring up, where we are kind of in a, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, because do we push on for the FA Cup and try to get our best chance of possibly winning a trophy? You know, I think that's a fair thing to say. Or do you play it a little safer and try not to risk these injuries? And this is something where it'll probably be a mixed bag. If you ask 100 different Palace supporters, you might get 50 and 50. But I think that the answer would probably be to use the players if the protocols that you have available to you are saying that they can be played. You know, if it's not a gut feeling, if it's saying, okay, he passed X, Y, and Z, if he gets injured, it's not because he's at risk, it's just a fluke thing, then I would let him play. I think that would be fair. But yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have three true natural central defenders on our squad, and we start three central defenders. So we don't really have a lot of rotation there. So it makes you wonder, you know, we saw this 4-2-2-2, 4-2-4 type shape, call it what you want, chasing Brentford over the weekend. We saw it earlier in the season against Leicester, a few other times. Is going to afford the back something that could be safer for us at the moment, considering our depth? Bobby, what do you think? Do you think this is something that we should actually look into, or are you saying if it ain't broke, don't fix it type thing with the back three?
Absolutely not. Yeah, no need to change the back four. It's all sign a centre back. It's as simple as you've got, ultimately, when you build a squad, you look for two players per position. In theory, you have that at right centre back with Richards, Klein and Ward. I mean, not the most attractive options, but there are three players who can play there, and you obviously only look for two. I don't see Joel Ward playing a game this season, so we'll call it Richards and Klein. At left centre back, you've got Mark Gaye and potentially Jefferson Lerma who can play there, but with issues in midfield, you think his primary position will be in the middle of the park. And then at central centre back, you've only got Maxence Lacroix. So you just need to sign a centre back for depth, almost accelerating that Gaye replacement who's targeted for the summer. Ideally, you would do that now, like they did bringing in Wharton in the last January, accelerating that midfield option who they plan to sign in the summer. So yeah, certainly, I don't think changing to a four at the back. I think Palace are pretty stable in their system. I think the one thing that's kind of worked for Palace this season is the system, albeit there's been attacking issues. The methodical kind of play is good. It just lacks that bit of spark up front, but the actual structure itself is there. So yeah, I just think it's about going into the market and picking out a centre-half to bring to the football club, to be honest.
Yeah, which won't be easy in the January market, considering the inflation of prices and the premium of that position. You're seeing a lot of centre-backs going in the market already. So it's a predicament that perhaps isn't Palace's own doing, and perhaps isn't on Parrish.
Yeah, I mean ultimately, Palace, you can't blame the club for the squad planning and the defensive, in the central defensive area, because at the start of the season, they had more than enough defenders. The only real reason they brought in Trevor Chalobah was because of Chadli Riad's injury. And then that was Trevor Chalobah was taken away from them by Chelsea. But it looks okay because they had Chadli Riad back. So they had their initial centre-backs they planned to have at the start of the season anyway. But now Riyad, unfortunately, injured. So it just forces Palace to now go back and recruit another centre-back. My thought is that it would likely to be a permanent rather than a loan. It makes more sense, ultimately. But we'll have to see on that front.
Yeah, and it does highlight, too, the importance of these, in baseball, we call them utility players. A player in the squad who is able to fill in at multiple different locations, especially at a squad like Palace where, you know, finances aren't going to be one of our strongest suits. We're not going to have as much funds as a lot of the clubs around us. So to have someone like Jefferson Lerma who can fill in at multiple different positions, I think is really valuable. Look in the past, players like Jeffrey Schlupp, you know.
It's only valuable, though.
You know, definitely some players that are valuable for the club to have. And I wonder if there's possibly someone out there in the market that could play kind of in that Lerma type position where he can play in midfield. He can play as a central defender, center back role, and maybe we get a two birds for one stone type scenario in the market. I think, I'm off the top of my head, but just
I think the idea would be to recruit a out and out center back who would be able to play this season and then take that more important role in the summer, if you like, once Mark Gaye departs the club. I think you raise a really interesting point with the word like utility player. Utility player is only useful when they're not required for their exact position. And at the moment, with only the real options of Will Hughes and Jefferson Lerma in midfield, Lerma's required there, so we can't really play at centre-back. Once Adam Wharton's back, then maybe we can have that conversation. But with the injury to Sheikh Doucouré and Daichi Kamada, other than West Ham, not looking very good in the pivot, then he's going to be required to play in midfield. So there's definitely, they need to sign a centre-back, whether that's to cover Lacroix or to cover that left-hand side, or someone who can do both. Because although it's important to have the structural of the back three of players in their best position, they can kind of move around anyway. So the importance is just to get another central defender.
Well, Bobby, do you not think, though, if if we're saying that signing a centre back is absolutely crucial, is signing a left back or attacking wing back, I want to call it, is that not just as crucial, signing a centre back?
I agree with you. Look, my thoughts on Tyrick Mitchell are pretty clear. I don't think he's good enough. I've said this for a while. He gives the ball away far too often. And in the final third, in a system that Oliver Glasner plays, he's just not got that kind of end product or quality. And it's not good enough for the system. I think if Palace were playing a back four, then Tyrick Mitchell is probably an ideal candidate to play at left back. But even if you look at his mistake in the build-up to the penalty, he just passed the ball straight out of play. He's in the penalty against Brentford, that is. He just passed the ball straight out of play, then Brentford pin Palace in their own box from the throw-on, and it would force Palace into mistake, or force Madsen to go into mistake. He's just not got anywhere near enough quality on the ball. So a kind of elongated way of getting to your question, yes, I think a left wing-back is a crucial position for Palace to add someone who is good with the ball. Do I think it's as important as a centre-back? Probably, because they've only got one position to play left wing. They've only got one player who can play the position anyway. So it's going to be a busy 7 days of the... Is it 7 days we've got left now? I don't know when you'll be listening to this. But about a week left of the transfer window. It's going to be busy. There's a lot of pressure on Palace to get the business done. Whether they will or not remains to be seen. I don't think the club are entirely certain in themselves what they're going to do, because they know the positions they want to recruit and the kind of profiles they want to recruit, but the names are kind of unclear because of how these injuries have come about out of nowhere and still getting plans in place and ball rolling.
It's interesting that you mentioned about the error of Mitchell's error before the Brentford goal, because just before Mitchell had just passed out of play, Eze did something magical to keep the ball, to retain possession. He's made a simple pass to Mitchell and he has the easy job, and then we lose the ball, and it just feels like we are limiting Eze's ability by not supplying him that player which would suit him in scenarios further up the pitch.
Yeah, you raise a good point, and he's not the most effective on the overlap. Teams can kind of just leave him be and not really worry. That there's a few times he puts really good crossing, but he crosses in, like in the Brighton game, an excellent cross to Sarr at the back post. But normally a big problem of his is taking a player on, and he's just not got that kind of ability. And as I already mentioned, he's a bit questionable on the ball. You raise a really good point with Eze. He needs that player to give him the delivery, because I did a piece on Roman Essien about how he likes to float into space, but he has the pace to do that. Now, Eze doesn't have the pace to do that, but he really likes to float into the space and find a place. So what he needs is a player to deliver him quality balls. So at the end of last season, you saw Elise on the right, who was doing it with a pace like Eze can do, but obviously at a higher quality, and Eze on the left, who was doing it a bit slower but finding the space. And he had Adam Wharton in midfield with those creative balls, just finding them all the time and putting chances on a plate for him. He could show his little bit of trickery and then bend a chance in. So that really and truly what you're missing is, yes, you're missing the left wing back, but you're also missing a creative midfielder who's got an incisive array of passing.
I don't disagree with your assessment of Mitchell's ability. But I do disagree that he can't play there. And I'll keep this succinct. He is a very good defender. He's actually quite good at playing final balls. Also, his actual assist numbers are pretty good. His XA numbers are good. His key passes are good. Not great at ball progression. Middle third, not good. You know, does not pass the ball accurately. Does not play and build up much. His instincts don't seem great there. I agree with everything you said in that standpoint. But he was the same player in spring of 2024 when we went on that majestic run, 13 matches, rarely losing, high-flying, scoring points, not really giving up a lot of goals either. He was the same player. If you break Glasner's era into three brackets, right, that last spring, first half of this season where we weren't good, second half so far of this season where we have had more success, the time frame where Mitchell was the most progressive by far in terms of his actions was that opening half of this season when we weren't performing well. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think when you ask him to be more progressive, when you ask him to do things he's not going to excel at because he doesn't have the qualities to do it, I think you're going to struggle. And we saw that full point firsthand. But that being said, it isn't fair to him to say he's not good enough, because he is a great defensive player and he's also good at playing those final balls. So,
but I didn't say he wasn't good enough. I said he's not good enough. I said he's not good enough for the system, which I don't think he is.
Right, and I and I'm and that's what and, I'm refuting.
So if we talk about it, people were always discussing about, oh, sorry, Mitchell should be in the England team, right? But when you play international football at the top level, you need a player who will never falter in attack as well as being strong defensively. And Tyrick Mitchell hasn't got that attacking ability. I don't really care what the numbers say about Tyrick Mitchell, because we all watch him every week. He makes too many mistakes. He gives the ball away a lot. He does have good crossing at times, but there's also far too many times where he just gives the ball away when he's in a great area. Taking players on, he's not good at. He's just wasteful, and it becomes quite frustrating to watch.
Yep. And look, this isn't a numbers thing only. I'm not a numbers guy only. I refute that notion every single time. For the record, everything you just said, the numbers do back up, because numbers and perception are the exact same thing. They're just one side of the same coin, but they do back up everything you said. But let's not look at numbers. For Glasner's system, he needs five players in rest defense. He needs five players out and out attackers, where that one player in rest defense can slide in and be a sixth man to run in and make final runs to overwhelm opposing fives or back fives or whatever you want to call it on defense. That's what we know. We know there's a rest defense of five and attacking block of five. Mitchell stays in that back block of five while Munoz pushes up, which means we have a back three, Mitchell, and then one of our central midfielders, which allows our second central midfielder to be a bit more creative, to push up, to attack, to create, to do all these types of things that we can have them do. Lerm was great at making box runs. Hughes does a great job of this, right? That's our five, and then we have our midfielder and our front four, including Munoz, our two tens, and our striker. If we get a left wing back in who is out and out attacking, like Diouf over at Slavia Prague, great player, but plays like Ahmad plays at Manchester United when he plays wing back, out and out attacker. If we do that, then we're going to have to drop one of our midfielders back to create that block of five still, because now we have two wing backs forward. If we overlook it and we have six attacking players and only four, we're going to get crushed on the counterattack. You want examples of that? Look to our first 11 matches this season when we were getting killed on the counterattack because Mitchell kept going too far forward.
Yeah, but I think Palace could almost do with keeping one of the midfielders back anyway, because so many times the goals just come through Palace over committing a midfield.
So if you keep five back, that would help a lot.
The second goal against Brentford, both Will Hughes and was it Jefferson Lerma were far too high.
100%. Which,
Brentford, huh?
Yeah, 100%.
And Brentford were just able to play an easy pass through, and it cut Palace in half. I agree that Tyrick Mitchell is very good defensively. You can't debate that. And as I say, if we are playing a back four, I think he's perfect for it. But Glasner has alluded to it himself. He said that Tyrick Mitchell needs to improve on his attacking ability about a month or two ago. And as I say, I just think Palace need a left wing back who retains the ball a bit better.
Which is fair. I think that's entirely fair. I haven't made a claim of pro Mitchell or anti Mitchell, because I'd rather stay impartial to it. I just wanted to point out how his system works. And if we do want an attacking wingback, we would need a more defensive-minded central midfielder, almost like a true defensive double pivot to put in front of the back three, which, again, no problem with doing. I think we could have the personnel for that. But it would just be a slight tweak to the system that we would need to have happen. It doesn't mean that...
Ultimately, right, Glasner wouldn't identify an attacking wingback as a primary target for the window if he didn't think it was an issue in his squad.
Exactly, and which makes me believe that he has the faith in the central midfield to have that block. But just an interesting insight into how that system works. It's really two rotating blocks of five, where one might push up where the other stays back, and then you do get that sixth man run from either Mitchell or one of those midfielders, or a lot of times we see Gehi in the center back position making that sixth man running up to overwhelm and outnumber for a numerical advantage for a goal. So just I thought a cool little insight into how it works and why Mitchell does work there, but why attacking player could even be a little bit better. So that being said, I think this would be a good chance for us to jump into the true nitty-gritty of the match on the weekend, a 2-1 defeat at the hands of Brentford. So our first loss in quite some time to a Brentford side that shows that the Palace Charity FC moniker is still sticking. Only Only one win away from home for Brentford this entire season going into this match, and they leave Selhurst Park with all 3 points. Max, I'll bring you into this one. What did you think about the match? How did you think we looked? Anything that really concerned you off the bat with the squad?
I just thought it was really boring, to be honest.
not wrong.
Like, genuinely, I was sat in the pub and I honestly could have fallen asleep. I just thought everything, we were just cancelling each other out. We weren't offering anything. They weren't massively offering much more than we were. It was kind of one of those Premier League games that comes around every so often where both teams kind of just seem to lose their quality and it kind of just it goes into nothing in a way. But I felt like it was a game where, I'm not going to go too much into this because we just had the big Mitchell debate, but it was a game that highlighted the left-back issue, and I touched on it earlier with the link-up with Eze was really missing. And for the second goal, if we're talking about defensive issues and the way forward, the player that scored, he is in. If you look at the video, he's in between. He stood right in front of Richards, and then he's in between Richards and Lacroix, and neither of them. There seems to be no communication between them. It was just such a poorly defended goal. He had a free header, and that shouldn't have been allowed to happen. We'll save the essay talk for a little bit later on. But in terms of the game, I just thought it was boring, and we didn't show enough to win the game. I don't think they massively deserve to win. I think a draw would have been fair, but on the day, that happens, doesn't it? It's a Premier League.
Yeah, there's the stigma you have to fight here in the United States with trying to get people to become fans of what we call soccer, what everyone else in the world calls football, basically, is the, oh, they don't do anything. They pass the ball around for 90 minutes and it's 0-0 the whole time. Usually you have to tell them how wrong that is and how nuanced it is. And the first 45 minutes or so of this match, I would say it would be a hard one to argue against that one for. It was a tough watch. It was a watch of labor a little bit, where both sides were not really trying to do anything to allow the other side to get a chance. I think in terms of chances created, I think the XG for both teams combined was maybe 0.3, which means that, you know, there's nothing going on in that first half. Bobby, I'll go to you. Anything you saw from the squad? How do you think Chris Richards looked in that new role, so to speak, now that Chalobah's gone, he's filling that void?
Yeah, I've been sceptical about Chris Richards recently, I must admit, but I thought he played probably the best of the back three against Brentford. It was one of his better games, certainly improved. So, yeah, I thought it was fine. But on the game itself, I thought it was two evenly matched teams, really. Both games this season have been pretty tight. Gone the wrong way, unfortunately, for Palace. But it was always going to be the team who made the first mistake who would lose the game. And unfortunately for Palace, giving away that decisive penalty, it kind of put the mark on the display, if you like. You always knew that Palace would likely lose the game from that point on. They almost thought they got away with it when Mbeumo missed, but unfortunately VAR got involved and faced the penalty again, and he wasn't going to miss it again. I mean, he's a top penalty taker at the end of the day, albeit that first one was a bit miscued. It wasn't miscued by far. It was disappointing. The performance was pretty boring in the first half. I thought it improved in spells in the second, but wasn't really good enough to win the game. So in the end, it probably was a fair result. Yes, you had the refereeing decision, but I do think it was a retake ultimately to the letter of the law. And albeit it was even, Palace were the teams who made the mistakes, so rightfully lost the game.
I could not agree with you more. I think you said it perfectly. To me, it was so very evenly matched, save for a mistake that led to a penalty, and that ended up being the difference in the match. You know, however you look at the eye test, any metric you want to break it down stats-wise, it was so close to 50-50. It just was one of those matches where, you know, it didn't break our way, and it's going to happen in a Premier League season. We've been on a good run. I don't think there was anything that was alarming in terms of how we were playing or what we were or were not doing that really makes me want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
I do think, though, just to challenge you on that, not even challenge you, but challenge you is the wrong word, just to spark the debate almost.
Yeah, I'm
Do
thinking out
think
loud.
There's something to be said about the last 7 or 8 games, even though results have picked up, the performances at times have still been a little bit flat. Palace have just started to take their chances. And I think the only real game where I can say that Palace were brilliant, and brilliant might still be the wrong word, was the second half against West Ham. There's not been a real period in any of these games where Palace have played well throughout. Against Leicester, they were clinical. It wasn't a pretty performance at all, but they got the 2 goals. Against West Ham, the first half, Palace edged it, but it still wasn't pretty. And the second half, they really pushed on it. And that's the first time you've seen that this season. And against Brentford, it was just that same similar theme that Palace were flat and they didn't have a difference maker that day. And ultimately, it was costly.
Yeah, but flat's a really good word to use. Well, not good for the way the team looks, but in terms of describing the way they're playing, you're absolutely right. I think the first 30 minutes or so of each match, it just seems to take Palace a while before they kind of get going. I don't know if it's a feel the team out thing and trying to come up with a way to break them down or what it is, but it's certainly something noticeable that continues to happen. So, yeah, it's a very good point you're raising with it. In terms of clinician, I think you're just seeing Oliver Glasner's sides. I think we've limited the mistakes that we've been making to allow any chances for the opposition. And in turn, that's going to allow us to try and go to our end and take what's ours. And now that we're becoming a little more clinical, I think that's why you're seeing the results. But I would agree that it's not over-encompassing this huge change. It's just these little nuanced things here and there that seem to be changing for us. And those little things just didn't seem to go our way on Sunday. So
I mean,
overall,
when you ask
yeah.
Oliver Glasner about what changed from the start of the season to now, he just says that the players are fitter and injured players are starting to come back. I don't know. It's a really weird one. It's one I struggle to get my head around because I don't think performances have changed too much. They've just started to take their chances a bit more.
Yeah, and to back up what he's saying with some numbers to kind of, give it some backing and corroborate it, our tackles attempts, like our rate of winning tackles has gone up, our rate of winning duels has gone up, our defensive errors has gone down, and our passive protective defensive action and our pressures actually have gone down. So it's almost like we've become this team that's comfortable in making our decisions. And more drilled, more focused on what we're doing, and not having to be so out of position and run around because we are better drilled. I mean, I could see it just with him being that our players are back and healthy and they're becoming more comfortable with each other. And to Max, to bring in your point, just like we talked about that second goal, which as an aside, Kevin Shoddy, by the way, I think I say his name, Shoddy, correct me if I'm wrong with the Brentford pronunciation of the player who scored their second goal. Hit. I seem to wonder if he always scores against us. I looked it up. He has 6 goals in his Premier League career, and 2 of them, so 1/3 of his total goals, have come against Crystal Palace. So another guy that we seem to just be gifting things to, as is our nature. But as you said on his goal, Max, it seemed like there might have been a miscommunication. Could that not be something that comes down to these players being healthy and gelling together and having that chemistry?
I think you could argue that. I think not to bring it back to Chalobah again, but it seemed like the back three was pretty solid. They'd built that chemistry, they'd built that kind of solid line, which as towards the end of Chalobah's games, you could see he was starting to drive the ball up more, and there was obviously a strong understanding between the three of them. So now we've basically just chucked in. We've chucked in Richards, and we've just hoped it's going to work. So yeah, I think looking at the goal, I don't think they massively communicated who was picking up who, and he was left free. And to be fair to him, it was a cracking header. But I don't think it's. I don't. I'm wouldn't be so sure how to word it. But I do want to go back to Bobby's point of we need a centre back. I don't. I'm not. I'm not saying. Not saying that whole goal was entirely Richard's fault, but between him and Lacroix, one of them has got to pick him up, right? I don't really think that that's unreasonable to expect.
My sense is that the side is really well structured, but it's kind of devoid of flair in attack. there's a good methodology. There's know-how, there's tactical now. That kind of gets Palace through games. There's almost an efficiency in the way they operate, but there's no elegance. There's no sparking attack. It's a team that's set up on steady foundations, but that only will get you so far when there's no real operator in attack who will grab the game by the proverbial and take it to a team. And I think if you look at Ebrahce Eze's numbers this season, while he's not been spectacular, if you take him out of the side, Palace don't create chances. And there's the over-reliance on him to create chances. While Ismaïla Sarr has been brilliant, and he's probably been Palace's best attacking player, he only works against the teams who play that higher line, so the Brightons, the Man City, if you like, when you can get him in behind playing off the last man. So there's just the lack of options in attack that can change games, which I wrote to that effect in my piece on Essay. And I think he'll be really important in the second half of the season because he's a smooth operator who identifies where the space is. He is different to Elise because Elise would stay out wide, whereas Essay will scan the space and go to where that space is in a real similar way to Eze, but just with the pace to it. And I think he's got that bit more flair, bit more skill, but obviously he's very raw and he's going to have to learn. So I personally, for me, I think they need another player like that of the Essay kind of mold for the left-hand side. So you just have more options at the back end of games. Because if you want to make a sub and take Eze off at 70 minutes, which Glasner has done quite a few times this season, your options are Eddie Nketiah and Daichi Kamada. And in that sense, you're not really changing anything on the left-hand side. It's kind of a much of a muchness. You need someone with a bit of pace who can open up defences and change games at the vital moments when they're a bit more open and, you know, you're going for the points. You need someone to change a game or you need a goal from somewhere. And that's what I think it is. There's a really good structure at the back. There's even a decent structure in midfield. The system is set up well. And often Glasner is coaching wins, but there's just not the players to make that difference and get the wins over the line.
I think that's exactly the point, except the players that we do have of that capability are injured. Like, how many times have we seen France play? And I think he's a player that you described there to come on, run at the defence, use his pace, create that option for Eze to be Eze. I don't understand.
But ultimately, you left the squad short at the start of the season in those areas, right? You signed Eddie Nketiah, who showed at Arsenal that he's not really a creator as such. He's a finisher. So to sign him to play minutes on the left 10 was a ludicrous decision. Matheus França, everyone knows he struggled with injuries, so there was no guarantee he was going to be available at any point this season. He's back in training now. Glasner's really happy with the progress he's making. So hopefully he's one we can see in the second half of the season. Daichi Kamada has fallen below expectations, but he's an attacking midfielder without the pace. He's more of a technician as such. So that's not the kind of profile player you want. So I think there's a real good structure to the 11, which comes from the boss. But the actual composition of the squad, especially in those attacking areas, is subpar. And I just think they need a bigger injection of speed, a bigger injection of directness and someone who can ultimately grab games by the balls.
Yeah, I think you've made some really good points. Different profiles sometimes makes the difference where you just have option B, option C coming off the bench. And I think this is no greater a time than to bring in our current direct, electric, dynamic option off the bench, our new signing, Romain Essay, who... if you're looking from strictly a statistical standpoint, no need to look at the sample size. I believe he's probably the most prolific player in Premier League history in terms of touches to goal ratio. So you've heard it here first. Best attacker in Premier League history, Romain Essay. I jest, of course. But Max, I'll bring you in. Just from your perspective as a fan, from what you were seeing as a supporter, with what you expect from Crystal Palace, how did it feel to watch him come on, perform, score right away, albeit in a losing effort?
Well, he definitely didn't waste any time, did he?
Certainly did not.
I think that kind of first however many seconds it was that he was on the pitch, he almost did exactly what he was meant to do. He found that space. What a pass from Eze, by the way. I want to make that clear, because I say a lot of... I am very negative on Eze, about Eze on this podcast. I'm very aware of that because I demand a lot from him, But what a pass that was. Munoz does well. And that's what we need. The player, the attacking player who has the instinct to be there at the right place at the right time with the finish. And there was loads of stuff going on Twitter about him going for the knee slide and him over celebrating. He's a 19-year-old lad who has just scored with his first touch in the Premier League. Everyone who wants to talk about this on Twitter isn't even in the position to be able to say what they would do there. He scored. I think the main point though of that game, although he was really good, is what he said in his interview after. He basically just said, "This is what I want to show Palace, and I want to keep doing what he's doing." And I think that's exciting to hear that he's going to be very, very confident now, and he's going to be knocking on the door. I know he's not played a lot. I don't want to get carried away, but it's quite hard not to. I'm very, very excited. But what I do want to ask you two is, how do we see? Bobby mentioned it a minute ago about, you know, if we bring Eze off on that left-hand side, like, what do we do? Would we not say that Eze and Essay are going to complement each other well? Because me personally, I want to see them on the pitch at the same time.
Yeah, I think they would. They would. We'd love to see him on. What he did coming off the bench, scoring was the best part, obviously. And I'm still saying, you know, like you said, pump the brakes. Don't go crazy about it. Don't expect him to score every time. He's going to be a great player for us, but we can't have these expectations that he's going to immediately change the game and just do this every time. He's not. I mean, he just isn't. He's going to do really, really well for us. He was electric. I love that he took the game over. He didn't look like a deer in headlights. But coming on for the last 15, 20 minutes of a match and showing what you can do, taking the most of your chances, that's what he needs to do right now. And I think that's what I would like to see him do for the next, you know, few matches at least, until he kind of creates a rhythm and, you know, forces his way into the starting lineup over Sarr so he can play next to Barry Eze and they can complement each other, as you said, because I think there is a good rapport with them.
No, I think
do too much
my only fear about Ebbs and Eze playing together is that they might occupy the same spaces. Because they both like to roam around, but sometimes that might just be Eze has to come in a little bit deeper, pick the ball up, play a crossfield ball, or carry the ball a bit more. We only know that until we see it as a frequent thing, and I don't think Sarr will be being displaced from the starting 11 anytime soon.
No, I definitely
picking up from some other things on Essay, I think it was the fourth fastest goal from a substitute this season, 1 minute and 59 seconds. The movement was majestic, as I mentioned a couple of times. He just scanned, he drifted into the middle, and then he burst to the left-hand side, calling for the ball. He didn't get the ball first time, but he kept on the side. He saw the ball go cross-field, and then he knew he just had to run into the back post and he was going to have an easy tap-in. So I was really impressed with that. But actually, I don't know if I mentioned it earlier on in the podcast, but the fact he did it again 2 minutes later, it was like around the 82nd minute mark, he started on the right, drifted into the middle, the ball was over on the left-hand side, he ran into that exact same space, wasn't picked up again. The pass was a bit delayed to him, so he got a bit late, so the Brentford defenders were able to get to him, and he had to play it off to Mitchell. But just that general alertness and being active when his movement was so good to see from such a young player. And it just shows you his football intelligence in abundance. And once Glasner starts to refine some of these little raw elements that he's got, he will be very important for Palace. But the best thing that I liked about him was that he was intent on coming on, even at 2-0 down, to change the game. Every time the ball came into the final third, his hand was up, even if the pass didn't look on and he was calling for a pass. His communication and his willingness to be involved and his desire to have an impact on the game is exactly what you want to see from a 19-year-old making his Premier League debut. And while I mentioned in my piece that I wrote on him, I don't know if anyone listening has read it, that it's important to be cautious with the optimism. He certainly showed the signs in his brief cameo that he is a player who can go on and make a very big impact for Crystal Palace Football Club.
Yeah, and I think that's what frustrated me too, the criticism of him celebrating. I think he just has fire. I mean, he cut the lead in half. I think he was ready to score another one and he was excited about it. So
yeah, and ultimately it didn't stop playing on anyway.
Absolutely.
Because Brentford had a player down injured. All right, you would kind of like to see a player pick the ball up and run to the centre circle in that situation. But what must have been going through his head? A 19-year-old scoring in the Premier League with his first ever touch in the English top flight, playing for a South London club where he's from. I mean, it just must have been an unbelievable, overwhelming feeling that none of us could ever imagine, because frankly, three of us on this podcast will never have the success he's just had. And yeah, as I say, it didn't really affect anything. It's not the end of the world. He's 19. Cut the kid some slack.
Yep, I think cut him some slack in terms of everything, in terms of his gameplay. If he has a bad performance here and there, he's learning. He's 19 years old. He's going to have a lot more good performances and do a lot more good things than he does bad things. I can tell you that right now. But let's just be patient with him. Max, any last words on SA? Anything that you saw with him?
I just think he's that exciting player that we really need. And when we talk of a player who's going to run at attackers, and yes, he's going to find the space, he's going to provide the passing option, but that's something that we've missed with, obviously, the man himself, Marc Elise, departing. We've missed that player to drive, because Ebbs doesn't really do it anymore. The running at players, trying to take them on, and then the one-twos that we used to see frequently of spring 2024, we see every so often now. But I think that player like SA can provide that dynamic that our team is just crying out for. And when I'm really excited for when Wharton comes back into the side to provide, because he's so good in that transition. So good in that transition. He can feed that ball to SA so well, and it's going to absolutely transform the team. I'm so certain of it. In my opinion, Wharton's the biggest miss out of everyone that we've missed from injury, whether it's been one game, a few games, not played at all. Wharton's a player that we're missing, and he's just going to act as a catalyst for everything that SA does.
Must be reading my mind with what I was about to end this with, because 100% we talk about how SA is a better finisher of those final balls and those progressive passes where he can create. Well, look at Elise last year, who was the player feeding him those passes a lot of the time. It was Adam Wharton. So Adam Wharton returning is going to make the club better across the board, but it's definitely going to make SA's life a lot easier, because he's going to be put into positions with those passes where he can succeed instead of having to create them on his own. Looking forward now, maybe a bit crazy to say 3-4 years ago, if you know, you were to tell somebody in it back then, but a mid-table matchup in February against Manchester United at Old Trafford. Max, since it's at Old Trafford, since it's Manchester United, should we be looking at it as a free hit, or is this an away match to a mid-table side that's beatable and maybe possible to get all 3 points there?
With the way that Man United are in right now, we've got to be able to take advantage of their form. Amorim says himself, the worst Man United team ever. Well, we need these are the games where we need to definitely win. I looked at something earlier that it was, I might be wrong, off the top of my head, out of all of the teams that we've got left to play, I think 6 or 7 of them are currently in the bottom half, something like that. Every game that we play around the teams around us, we have to win, because we are, although we can hold out a result against teams like City and Chelsea, and we can do quite well in and playing for a point and things like that. With State of Man United right now, we need to go with a full intent to win that game, full intent. And I'm hoping that the players use this minor setback of Brentford to get back into the way we were, because when you look at our form before, we lost to Fulham on the 9th of November, and then we hadn't, apart from the two Arsenal defeats, we haven't lost since then. So we should be going into games of confidence, and just we need to rebound off Brentford and attack the team that's in a very vulnerable position.
Yeah, as you said, it is so close in those mid-table spots. Two bad weekends in a row, and that's the difference between possibly being scraping for the top half and being down in 15th. So you know, as absurd as it sounds, this is a squad where if you removed the badge, removed the sponsor on the front, the badge on the front, the familiar colors, it would be a mid-table Premier League side, and I think we need to treat it as such. Bobby, is there anything that you're going to be looking for specifically as we go up to Old Trafford on the weekend?
Yeah, make no mistake about it. This is a laughable Manchester United side. It's not a free hit. Absolutely not. It's a game that you've got to be looking at to at least take a point from, but probably win. I think I just want to see a bit more spark and attack from Palace up there. I want to see Palace take the game to Manchester United because they squirm whenever anyone gets in their face and gives them a go. They're weak defensively. They're not particularly good in attack. They don't know who their best striker is. Both Xerxes and Højlund haven't scored in God knows how long. Yeah, they're a very poor side, and Palace have got to be looking to take something from that game.
I would agree. Let's look forward to the end of the window here. I'm going to ask you guys to make some predictions. You can be as vague or as specific as you would like to be with these. But Max, I'll start with you. Predictions for the end of the transfer window. How many players do you think we get in? And if you want to elaborate on that, what positions do you think? And if you have any names, again, this would all be just speculation. Feel free to just name positions if you'd like to.
I think definitely centre-back is crucial. For me personally, left wing-back is just as crucial. Due to the Doucouré injury, we need another centre-mid because we can't be relying on a recovering Adam Wharton to provide that quick fix in the centre-midfield role. So I think we definitely need a new midfielder that I would personally like to bring in someone, as much as I like Hughes for the job that he's done over the past year or so. And I am a fan of Lerma in general because I think he's such a runner and he's got a lot of passion for the club, which I always like. But we desperately just need someone of Wharton's level next to him. I don't think that's going to happen this window, though. Like, I made that very clear. That's not happening this window. But we need to bring someone in centre mid, left wing back, centre back. I would be content with that. I think we should get three. I couldn't tell you. At this rate, we might get another one, maybe two. I couldn't tell you, but I want at least three.
Yeah, I think I would go ideally four: an attacker, midfielder, central midfielder, left wing back, and a central defender. I think ideally we get, that's how many we get, but I think we end up getting one, maybe two. One being a central defender, a center back, and the maybe two would be a wing back. Bobby, real quick to you, if you want to participate in this.
Yeah, I mean, what I want to happen and what will happen are two very different things. Ultimately, as I've said throughout this episode, I believe the squad is short. So if I was the one calling the shots, I would be looking for four, a wing back to cover and compete with Mitchell, a centre half, another attacking option on that left hand side, and a central midfielder too. But what I think will happen will be a left wing back and a centre half. So yeah, two more in my opinion. Going back to what I want to happen, ultimately you're looking at another rebuild in the summer because signing four players in January is completely unrealistic. And yeah, it's just disappointing really because the squad is short. It will remain short until the summer when they try to rebuild again, but that didn't work very well in the this summer when they didn't complete the jigsaw of replacing Michael Olise with different profiles. So it's just the joyous world of Crystal Palace transfers and seeing what happens. It will be, things will happen late on now. Some question marks over whether Diouf can happen, with Palace potentially being priced out with Slavia Prague's latest asking price. And naturally, the latest injuries to Chaddy Rehad and Sheikh Doucouré have shaken up plans with Crystal Palace yet to decide really on those finalised targets.
If Diouf goes to Brighton, then there needs to be questions asked to Parrish because he can't let that happen. No way. He can't go to Brighton.
I wouldn't want to see it either.
I say something.
It will be a nightmare. I can't even think about it.
Well, I'm going to wrap it up here, guys. Got like 3 minutes.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Well, that is all the time we're going to have to talk about today. Again, I am Pat, and I thank you guys for listening. Bobby, we appreciate you, especially in January, busy month for you. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you very much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Of course, Max, as always, thanks for coming on, having a chat.
Oh, always love to be back, Pat. Always love it. Thank you very much.
Of course, love having you here. And remember, as always, if you would please kindly leave a review wherever you listen to your podcast, whatever platform that you use. And remember, as always, feedback is appreciated. If you would, wherever you listen to your podcast, give some reviews. Of course, we would prefer 5 stars over anything else, but any constructive criticism is appreciated for us to improve and get better. If long format reads articles are more of your jam, you can go to thepalaceway.com for article format of Palace writings on the academy, on matches, match reports, transfers, and always follow us on socials at The Palace Way. Please remember to follow us on socials at The Palace Way on Twitter and Blue Sky. That's all I got. I think we have an Instagram, but I don't know what it is, so I'm not going to plug it there. All right, guys.